Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We're giving you choices and knowledge of those choices to help make your dreams come true. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. And we come your way Sundays at 7 a.m. and 7 p.m., Mondays at 1 a.m. We stream live at richarddugan.com. The radio show's page is where we archive the programs. And we also link to our guests. We'll be giving you the website shortly to help you to find them, get information about them, and the work that they are doing, as well as a book that we're going to be talking about. I was originally going to start out this program by saying, surprise, it's Tell Me Your Story, but you knew that already. And we're so grateful that we have in studio a couple that I believe we have had on the program before. We are going to be talking about, it's an incredible book. You really need to get a copy of this. The Not-So-Little Book of Surprises, which is not so little. It's larger than an 8.5 by 11 sheet of paper. And it is by Deirdre Haid and Will Arntz. And I want to thank both of you for joining us. And your photographer did some incredible work. We'll talk about that as well. Thank you again for joining us.
Thank you. So happy
to
be here.
We had a great time, had a great opportunity to meet you, of course, in person for the first time at the Sacred Space, which is an incredible place to be. If folks haven't been out to Summerlin and that particular location, I highly encourage you to do so. Even if you're just trying to get away for the day, you can hang out, and it's just a great energy there. We've even had the proprietors on this program back in, I think, 2007, 2008. It's been a while. We need to get them back on here. But you folks have put this, again, it is just an incredible hardcover, which is, in this day and age of digital everything, kind of an unusual venture to put it out in hardcover. And the photographs, as well as the content, the text information, the messages that you put in there. Where did this concept come from?
Well, the concept, I mean, it really starts like 10 or 15 years ago with Deirdre doing her teaching and writing poetry and just amassing this incredible collection of teachings and wisdom. And they were just sitting around on the bookshelf, 10 volumes, and I got the bright idea to extract out of them the quotes and some of the poetry and put them together in a book with pictures. And it came as a surprise to me to do this, and it happened so quickly. And in 3 months, the book was done. So it was it happened at light speed.
In other words, all the parts were already there. You just needed to work together to put them together.
Yeah, and the other part of it, the images by Indre Balog, he's a photographer, obviously, but also a concert violinist, and he had something like 3,000 pictures laying around on his websites that he didn't really know what to do with. So I was the kid in the candy store. I had this incredible wisdom and knowledge in transcripts and Andre's photographs, and it was just time to put it all together.
I would love to have these images, like, for example, on my phone and change out my desktop picture, background, screensaver, all of those things, because these are really, because some of them are incredible as far as what I see as the images themselves, but some of them are rather poignant. I saw one, what did I just flip by here? I saw one, a cracked egg, which I thought was really interesting. I don't know that I would necessarily use that one, but nonetheless, here it is. And this is actually, it's just a great work. I mean, this is an oversized book that a great coffee table book, I suppose. Mm-hmm. But it's not something that, you know, you'd sit there and read. But some of the things, for example, that you'll find in here, I'm not even going to attempt. You're going to have to get a copy of the book to see these pictures. So I'm not even going to attempt to describe them. But I will say that on this one particular page, you are diamonds in the eyes of God. And again, these are all your, all your writings.
Yes.
And again, some of them are nice and short. Some of them are a little longer. All of our souls want connection to the mystery. What mystery?
The mystery of life, the mystery that we can't really see or touch, but we know it's there. We feel it's there. We feel it when we feel a great surge of love. We feel a deep connection with someone. We have an experience in nature. The mystery is really in our feelings and also in our intuition and our deep senses.
Intuition. Let's talk a little bit about that. That subject comes up more often because I intentionally bring it up because it's fascinating to me, especially with some of the experiences that I have had. Tell me about the experiences that the two of you have had as individuals, but also as a couple, as far as your intuition, and maybe even sharing with us the level of connectedness that the two of you have. And I mean, my gosh, look at this work that's come out of it.
Well, thank you. Putting this book together was really put together by intuition. Will went into these volumes of work that I've been writing and receiving messages from the mystery for over a decade. And he, through his intuition, pulled out what he felt was needed right now in the world for inspiration, for wisdom. The mystery lives in our intuition, and it's so important right now that we look within to our intuition, because our intuition is where our wisdom is. It's what protects us. It's what tells us which way to go. It really is another sense that it's time to pay attention to. And this book came from intuition.
Will?
Well, for me, I was just thinking about that. You said about ourselves personally and as a couple. So I'm going to go with the couple part of it. I'm in my mid-60s. And about 5 years ago, I had met Deirdre, and we had spent some time together. And at one point, my intuition just said, marry her. And I'd never been married. You know, I was in my 60s, never been married. I guess you'd call that a confirmed bachelor. And it just at the same point, it was just like, oh, that was the thing to do. It's like, you know, you know you have to get to Rome, and there's the road right there, and it's just so obvious. And so to me, the decision, which I had avoided for decades, was, oh, let's get married. And it just was the obvious thing to do. And so for intuition, it often lands like that, where it's not like the big thunderbolt from the sky, although sometimes it is, but it's just often just a quiet knowing of like, oh, that's the next step. So, you know, and what we hope with this book is people are inspired to, because there's lots of little things in there about listening to your intuition. There's a great quote about how to listen to nature. And if you listen to nature, nature will tell you secrets of wonderful things. So, you know.
Well, and I couldn't agree with you more on that. I mean, I'm fortunate. My wife and I are very fortunate that we live in the rural part of Santa Barbara, up above what they call at the top of the pass. And in addition to our animals that we have, domestic animals, we have a deer family, a mama who's had two babies that are wandering the property that we live on. We've seen a bear. We have a little family of quail that you can hear from time to time, especially when Mama's doing that little clicking noise to protect them. And on and on and on. I mean, as a matter of fact, at night sometimes we will hear the resident owl hooting, which drives my dog crazy. he's a protector, and he thinks that that's a threat, so he starts barking. That's just the way it is. But that's one of the keys that we can talk about, too, is – and this is just my observation, and I'd love for the two of you to expound on it. My observation is that if you are dealing with a challenge, and it doesn't matter in what aspect of your life, if you take a look at nature, you will find the answer. And I use this simple analogy. What species, other than man, stocks and stores away food for more than a season? There isn't one. Other than, I mean, my gosh, we've got stuff that'll stay on the shelves for 15, 20 years.
Right.
Not necessarily any good for you, but it will stay on the shelves and supposedly edible for 15 or 20 years. Well, you know, you know the story of the what is it, the squirrel? I want to say the ant and the squirrel, the story where they're, you know, one of them just kind of lounging around and the other one is stocking up for the cold weather that's coming, the winter that's coming. And, you know, and then the next season rolls around, spring, and the cycle starts all over again. And it's not oppressive. It's just what they do. That's one way when I hear about the predator and the prey, I think, well, yeah, but that's our judgment on them. That's just the way life is for them. You know, it's neither good nor bad, which kind of leads me to this wonderful little center part of the book. One side is white and the other side is dark. The side that's white has dark lettering that says the darkness serves the light if you are conscious. The other side, which is black with white lettering, is the darkness is just the darkness if you are unconscious. And I think that from the context of, you know, the animal kingdom, if you will, and the way that they are, and I've even heard it said that, well, yeah, but see, they weren't predator and prey thousands and thousands of years ago. They weren't doing that kind of thing. Supposedly, I don't know if this is true, they learned that from man. Yeah, I don't know. But nature seems to be the greatest teacher.
Oh, absolutely. Nature, held in nature is all the knowledge, all the wisdom of everything. And if you look at the great prophets, they received their incredible truth from spending time in nature, you know, under the Bodhi tree and the cedars. And we can too. And through our intuition, you can listen to nature and hear nature and hear receive information that will bring you hope, inspiration, you know, help us with life struggles. We're all struggling right now. Most people that I work with and talk to are confused about what's going on in the world, confused about the planet. And what I hope in the Not-So-Little Book of Surprises to bring to you are these truths that I've gleaned from nature and also from the angelic realms, over a lifetime, the information they've given me that they say, give this away, to give this to you to help us can get through this time we're getting through, to thrive.
I'm going to read that because I love this thing, and I can brag about it since I didn't write it. Deirdre does. And it's from the book. And there's a picture of a bee there that we took. The picture of the bee is about 6 inches tall, and you can see all of its little whiskers. It's quite amazing, and it goes something like this. There was a time when you knew how to understand nature's language. Listen, and she will teach you of stars and realms, of magical things, of truth and wisdom unseen. For when you learn to speak to her again, all of nature will be your friend.
You know, and of course, we're speaking primarily of the animal kingdom, insects included. But we just planted a little greenhouse. It's sort of a repurposing of an old chicken coop, a very large one. Turned the nesting boxes on their back and then filled them with dirt. And we're growing plants. And when we first planted, it was really slow. And of course, my wife was a little impatient. I said, no, you have to relax. They'll come up when they're ready. You know, this kind of thing. Because some of the stuff she planted from seed, others from little sprouts. And they are just going nuts. And I go out there and, yeah, I talk to them. I say, you guys should look, you know, and it's not one of those things. Well, I don't know. I'm a guy. You don't talk to plants, you know. All right. You guys, you're looking good. You know, kind of sarcastically. No, because what they are producing, we're going to be eating. And then hopefully when we get our chickens, then they will get the scraps. Then we'll still continue to receive from that wonderful garden, and then we'll replant and so on and so forth. And I think it's one of those aspects, you know, especially in our modern day in the 21st century, which still kind of blows me away. I still flash back to the 60s when I was a kid growing up watching the Jetsons. And it's like, okay, where are the flying cars? They say they're coming now. But there is so much that we really don't need. And there's a lot of stuff we say we want because we are sort of, and I know people that will may or may not agree with this, they say we're programmed to want these things. You know, it's just like we've been inundated by the marketing and so forth. You know, I don't know about you folks. We watch a fair amount of television, but it's all on demand. So we can watch it when we want and stop it and pause it and do and so forth. But there's this one service, which is Hulu. Every once in a while, this thing comes up before the show starts and it says, which promotional item would you much rather watch? Well, first of all, I've never seen the commercials before.
Mm-hmm.
And I am not your marketing department. And so I actually have found a way to force them to choose. And I don't have to. My choice is I back out one and it backs out. It starts, I don't care which commercial, and then goes on to the program. Which I don't, and again, I don't mind the commercials, but it's like, why are you asking me which one I would like to see? Because I don't even know what you're wanting to show me. You know what I'm saying?
But yeah, it's relentless in this, in the society, this whole thing about, you know, and I mean, to me, the worst part of that is you have like these PhD scientists in psychology who study child psychology, who have learned how to have see if they can trigger a tantrum by a young kid in an aisle of a supermarket so mom will buy that particular thing. I mean, I've read where they have studies to do this. You have PhD. I mean, talk about black magic. I mean, here you have people using their knowledge to get a little 8-year-old to throw a tantrum. I mean, whoa. So,
yeah.
I mean, we don't want to get into too much,
no.
I think people, you know, need to realize in this society how everything is coming at them. And and I think it's important to listen to nature because nature doesn't do that. Nature's just there and you go to it and have a meeting and being able to do that is really about the only way you can detox from this constant barrage that we're all under these days of people trying to grab just a little bit of your attention for their own means.
Yeah. And I mean, yeah, we're sort of trying to drag get people's attention as well.
Well, you know, the thing is that in our world today, most of the areas where people are pulling on us to get our attention, they are wanting to take from you. They're wanting to take your energy, your money, your time, your consciousness, your thoughts, your feelings. They want to suck you dry. Really, that's what's happening. That's why we're all so tired right now and overstressed. Then there are places where people want to give you energy, want to make you feel, they want you to feel better. They want you to feel fuller. They want you to be healthier. And my advice would be to really listen to your intuition of, you know, what makes you feel good and what doesn't. So with the Not So Little Book of Surprises, you know, we're just here to get the word out. But this really is a book of energy and a book of consciousness to fill you with positive thoughts and positive awareness. This book won't take anything from you.
Well, I'll tell you what, if you're not mesmerized by the text, you certainly will be in a combination with that and the photographs, so the various pictures. Some of these are just, they're quite remarkable, and these are all photographs. These aren't necessarily like digitally enhanced, produced, photoshopped. Although,
yes,
some of them are. Which again that's fine. But the fact of the matter is that it's just astounding. And obviously, he used. I love this one of the strawberries because I'm a fan of strawberries, especially here on the Central Coast.
Yeah, Andre he's won awards, international awards for his photography. He also happens to be an international concert violinist who was soloing with the LA Philharmonic at the age of 8. So he's a prodigy and a real dyed-in-the-wool artist, which is why he had 3,000 pictures laying around, didn't know what to do with them, because he's such an artist, he's not a marketer.
Yeah, he's taking photographs with real intent.
Oh, yeah.
Yes.
Okay. I had heard, and I don't know if this is still accurate. It might be less than what it is today. But a few years ago, I remember there was a study or there was a survey. I forget how they came up with this, that estimated that every day on the planet, because of the availability of cameras, obviously in our phones, there are upwards of like 40 billion images taken. And the majority of them, probably 99.9% of them, are never seen. In other words, the person will take the picture and it stays in that device and it's never seen.
Mm-hmm. Wow.
And then, of course, there's the other side of it that people are so busy taking these pictures that they're never going to look at again that they miss where they are.
Right.
Yeah.
They miss the experience.
Yeah. They miss the experience, the connection with the energy. Mm-hmm. I want to talk a little bit about the two of you separately as individuals and where you have come from, your upbringing, especially from a, whether you want to call it a religious or philosophic or spiritual perspective. Mm-hmm. Will?
Well, I mean, growing up, my family, especially on my mother's side, was very religious. A lot of my grandfather was a minister. Uncles were ministers. Uncles were missionaries. My cousins either became missionaries or married missionaries and or ministers. So, and it was Presbyterian. So it was sort of that type of Protestant. And I basically, at a fairly young age, decided that wasn't for me. It was this moment in Sunday school when they were talking about us people not accepting Jesus and then frying in hell forever. And I said, if a 2-year-old baby in India dies, do they spend the whole eternity frying in hell? And I was told, yes, yes. And at that point, I just remember, and I was fairly young. I was maybe in eighth grade. I just remember just turned the switch off. I'm like, I don't believe any of this stuff now. So I went the other way into science. Got degrees in science and got a job as a physicist. But it's kind of funny. I kind of got into the whole spiritual thing through the study of metaphysics.
Ah.
And at first, I would read all the trippy stuff about time and you know, the metaphysical theories on that. And I would ignore all the things about meditating and improving oneself because I figured, who cares about that? And after about 10 years of ignoring it, I got the notion I was throwing the baby out with the bathwater. So then I started meditating and then really got into a whole life of looking at it. And I sort of came in through the Eastern religions, you know, Buddhism, Hinduism and whatnot, because they weren't as dogmatic in the same way as the Christianity. But the more and more I studied, then I start revisiting Christianity and kind of looking a little deeper, reading the Gnostic Gospels and saying, it's all the same thing. So I sort of went way out of my way to avoid it all and sort of came back in through the back door.
Mm. Deirdre?
Well, I grew
And by the way, here's the real story now.
No, I wouldn't say that. So let's see, I was christened Catholic. My grandmother was Catholic. My father was a research scientist in physiology and biochemistry. My mother was a research scientist in physiology. And my father left the church. He had a big there was a big drama in our house when I was about 5, and we left the church. We moved to the South, and my parents were very much humanitarians, but there was no God. Science was God. At that time, I had a few experiences. I had a vision of a truck running over my little brother, where my brother was brand new. Brother was sleeping, and I ran and got him out, and sure enough, a pickup truck did run over that tent. So that was kind of family folklore. And then later on, I had an experience of overdosing on aspirin, and I left my body, and then I decided to come back. And after that happened, I was about 7. I started seeing and being visited by these very tall beings, and they identified themselves as angels. And they started teaching me and talking to me about life and how it all works and what it all means. Because my parents were scientists, they said I had a very active imagination. And I went into the gospel churches there in the South to kind of find some answers. Then when I was around 16, my mother came home from the hospital, and we were told that she had a year to live. She had metastasized breast cancer. Now, this was like in the early 70s. They didn't have the treatments they do now. And she was very depressed. We were all very sad. And then I just started praying with my mother. It prayed so deep. And then one night a light filled in the room. I was running around trying to turn the lamps off, but they were already off. And we were like, where did this light come from? And then my mother said, wow, my pain is gone. And she ended up living 13 years longer than they said was even possible.
Wow.
So when this happened, I really began to, in earnest, you know, dig deep. I wanted answers. I wanted to know what this light was. What happened? I was given a Xerox copy of A Course in Miracles. It was before it was printed. This gentleman
That's
came
one
to town.
Stack of papers, too. I have a copy in the Onion paper. And
yes.
It's still pretty thick.
It's really thick. And my mom and I started studying that. And then I went on my life's journey. I studied Hinduism. I went to India. I spent time in Israel. I went on a spiritual quest in Israel. And all along, I'm collecting knowledge because I am very blessed to hear these angels that came to me as a child, you know, speaking to me, giving me wisdom and knowledge that's in this book. It's so funny. At the end of my father's life, he said to me, you know, I think I believe in your miracles. And he came around. Mm. He said, you know, I thought science was the answer, but I was wrong. Science without a greater presence it's gone wrong.
Mm-hmm.
That was way at the end of his life. So that's just a little bit of my story and where it came from.
I find it interesting too that your parents chose to leave the church, the Catholic Church, and go to the South.
Yes, that was very interesting.
Wait a minute.
well, they went to Duke.
You're going from one side to the other,
right,
so to speak. You know,
he had a opportunity to do his residency for his PhD at Duke University, so that's why we went to the South, and then we ended up in Memphis, Tennessee. He taught. Did research at St. Jude's Hospital. That is pretty interesting.
Yeah, and of course, I myself and my family, born and raised Catholic, and I've had the opportunity I actually interviewed my parents on this program and talked with them about that whole aspect of, well, why this direction versus that direction and so forth. And they wanted us to have some kind of it. It wasn't as if we are going to raise Catholic children.
Mm-hmm.
They just wanted us to have a foundation. They
right.
wanted us to have something initially, and then they allowed us to go in our respective directions. And for me, Will, for example, I started out at 17. My first metaphysical primer was Autobiography of a Yogi, and that's how I began my definitive search. And then, of course, I worked for 15 years for a Christian radio station back in Phoenix. Which was the best education I was ever paid for. I learned not only a little bit about broadcasting, comparative religions, and sociology and political science and all the, because everybody was involved in some way in many of these other aspects of life and living in these different philosophies. And so when you talk about I say that I started my search when I was 17, and I remember sharing that with someone, one of the ministers there, and they said, oh, well, once you find Jesus, your search is over. And I said, well, no. Once I find Jesus, it's just begun.
It's just begun. Right.
And I have to tell you, I prefer reading the apocryphal gospels and scriptures rather than the New Testament or the Old Testament, because it's like, wait a minute, why are you not wanting me to read this? It's one of those things where you don't tell a kid, don't do that, because they're going to do it. Well, that's exactly what I did. I find that information so interesting. I refer to a lot of those types of things as the ancient wisdom teachings that people don't want you to read. They don't want you to have any contact with that information, because it will free you. It will set you apart from the mainstream, which is not a bad thing sometimes. But I also think, too, that we need to stay connected with the mainstream from the standpoint that they need our help, too. You know, we're all here together, right?
Yeah.
We're all here, and we're all connected.
Yeah.
Let's talk a little bit about that connection that we as human beings have. You know, we have to go through a lot of different layers in order to do that, because we have placed a lot of layers between ourselves and other people, whether it's from a political or a religious or economic or social or whatever structure you want to put up. We have to tear that down just to get to the humanity of which we all belong.
Yeah, and it seems like that sort of thing, like people have forgotten the art of disagreeing. I mean, there's an art to disagreeing where you disagree with someone, but you still respect them.
Yeah.
And of course, you see this mostly in the political world. I read a book some years ago. It was called The Gipper and what was his name?
Tip O'Neill.
Tip and the Gipper.
When
politics worked. Yeah. And they talked about how the two of them, they disagreed almost violently on their ideology and what the way that they thought would do. However, there was a respect between the two of them.
Yeah.
And there was something, and one time when Reagan won a big thing over Tip O'Neill, Tip calls him up and says, "Well, Mr. President, I want to congratulate you on your victory. I know this means a lot. It was hard fought, and you know, congratulations." And that sort of thing, where people would work together in order to, I mean, they're both going for the common good, but they just have different ways of doing it, but at least respecting that. And I think that nowadays everything is so fragmented where there is no respect for other opinions. And because of that, everyone gets polarized in what they're thinking, and then it just ends up nothing gets done. And I think that thing where, you know, you see this among religious people too, where there's this intolerance between these different religions. It's like, wait a minute, everyone, don't we, you know, both your books say there's God, both your books are saying, you know, love your neighbor, and you're hating your neighbor right now who doesn't agree with you. So I just want to put that out there, it's a lost art form that I think needs some revisiting these days. Mm.
And the other thing, too, we're looking at is really I think what's up with all of our social media, with the conversation now and the political landscape and the polarization. And there's a topic that no one's really talking about that we need to address, and that is that hate is hate. Hate's the same no matter what side of the fence you're on or what you believe. Mm-hmm. It is a spiritually toxic energy. It's an energy that will make you physically sick, mentally sick. It warps our thoughts and leads people to do actions that they normally wouldn't do. It takes you out of your right mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm seeing a lot of hate coming up.
Yeah.
And this is our shadow. This is the part of our human self that we don't want to look at. But the gift of this is, I say in the book, if we approach this consciously, we can learn. There's great lessons we can learn at this time. But I would really, really coach people to do everything to stay out of hate. Hate is different than having anger. Like if you can say, well, I'm angry that tree got burned down. I'm angry that people aren't taken care of. That's a righteous anger. And anger, you know, I'm angry if, like Martin Luther King was angry.
Mm-hmm.
But as Martin Luther King said, hate is too great a burden for me to bear.
Yeah.
Because it is a burden. So that's a difference I think we want to really look at today in our conscious evolution of who we are.
I think that there was such an incredible example of that a former president of South Africa, Nelson Mandela. Mm-hmm. And I remember seeing a documentary and hearing the stories about how, in spite of the fact that he spent 25 years in prison, and amazingly enough, then went on to be the president of South Africa, which I thought, now that's the way to do it. Get your prison time out of the way first, then go into politics. But what I thought was interesting was his decision early on. And he, I recall him talking about this, that he says, you know, I could have I could have gone in one of two ways. I could have gotten even more bitter and more angry and more resentful and more violent and so forth, or I could let all that go. I could just, in a manner of speaking, just do my time and, you know, and choose to live a different kind of life. And he chose the latter. He was, if I'm remembering correctly, in his past, before he was in prison, he was a violent individual. I mean, that was part of what the group that he was with fostered. And that's what they were about. But he, when he got in there, he says, no, I can choose. And it's one of the things that we talk about on this program, that we always have choices. We don't always know what those choices are, which is the reason why we have all kinds of different people on this program, so that you hear about different choices, different ways of doing things. We're looking for those new ways of living because the old ways, they are not working. Just look around you.
Right. And spiritually, my understanding from my lifetime of study, and by the way, I will also say that I've been a student of and studied the ancient mystical Kabbalah for over 20 years, which is extraordinary wisdom and knowledge. And, you know, one thing I just want to share is that, speaking of choice, is spiritually we are here to see and know the difference between the good and the not good, and then to make a choice for the good. Mm-hmm. And those choices are not always easy. You know, it's not easy to override anger. It's not easy to override feeling justified. And one thing that Nelson Mandela did say was, when they asked him, how could you, you know, forgive your prison guard? How could you have a relationship and not hate these people? Mm-hmm. And he said, well, I spent all my time trying to understand their position.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the key is to peace, is to understanding someone else's position. And he even put some of those people in his cabinet, because once he understood their position deeply, like what motivated them to be the way they were, they actually changed. And that's where we have the power, that once you understand an opposing party all the way to the core of, like, what drives that person, that's where the mystery comes in. That's the miracle and that's the magic, because there is a sacred alchemy that when you understand deeply, the other person's consciousness shifts. It literally shifts. Mm-hmm. I've seen it. I've experienced it. But it takes a great amount of tenacity on one person's part to have that level of understanding.
You know, you bring up an extremely important point. I'm seeing a little bit here and there programs, television programs, and even movies where obviously the whole point is to get people to tune in and watch. So you're going to have the drama, trauma, and all of that. But then when you get down to the last quarter or fifth of the presentation, whether it be a movie or a television program, suddenly you see the combatants, shall we say, sitting down and finally dialoguing over what's got them so riled up. And I was watching a program. It was called The Last Ship. It's about this one military vessel that is sailing the oceans because there's been this plague and they now have the antidote. And they sail up to this one island and there's this group of people that they want to help. They genuinely want to help, okay? Well, this group of people has just been had, if you will, by another ship that came in with allegedly a vaccine that killed off most of their people. And so the leader, he's enraged. And so he goes after this group of people. Well, they end up taking out the rest of his people except for him. They put him in the brig and they're off. And finally, they start to dialogue. And the captain starts to understand where this guy is coming from and vice versa. And they end up joining forces. And of course, I realize that if they did that at the beginning of the program, there wouldn't be any program. But what you're saying is absolutely true, that if we could just stop and begin that process of understanding the other side, we would be a whole lot further along. Here we are in the 21st century. I'm in my late 50s, and we're no better off today than when I was six.
Right. That's the conundrum right there. And what you also are saying that is so important is that, you know, the darkness serves the light if you are conscious. Story. You know, we are a story. We're living a story. Mm. We all have the beginning of the story, the middle, and then the wrap up. So what I'm saying is, there'll always be story. There's always drama. There will always be disagreement. What I'm saying is, wake up, if enough of us can wake up and be conscious through the story, so that the end, there is a healing. At the end, there is a dialogue. In the end, there is a misunderstanding. Because how many stories do we live where the end is a disaster zone, mm-hmm. where there are bodies strewn everywhere, estrangements, people that used to love each other hate each other, families torn apart, countries torn apart? That's the end of our story. Mm-hmm. What I'm saying is, let's write a new ending to our story. Mm-hmm. We will always have drama. That's not going to go away. It's part of the consciousness of being in this world, just the way in nature. You have spring, you have summer, and then you have winter. Things die.
Yeah.
But nature works with that. Nature works with the death of the what happens in the cold, and spring comes back. And that's what we want to begin to emulate and become conscious beings, come be awake humans.
And Will, it also draws in what you said before, the fact that there's that such a lack of respect for one another when we take opposing positions. I mean, I ran into people as we went through the last campaign who took a different position than I would. And of course, I tried staying out of it. I got sucked in September. And I found myself, I felt like I was stuck in a net of some sort. And it took me 5 months to cut my way out of this net and to let that go and let people have their positions. Because it wasn't working in other areas to have that going on. I mean, but that's what you were talking about earlier in terms of having that respect, that common respect for one another.
Yeah, I mean, there's a famous line, we agree to disagree.
Mm-hmm.
So if you agree to disagree, at least now you've agreed about something.
Yeah.
And so that's something that thing that people, it's like, you know, and there's something in human nature where it's kind, you want to feel like you're right. You know, you want to feel like
ego.
Yeah, the ego has all the answers. I've got the answers, and you disagree with me. Well, I can't agree with you now, because then that means I'm wrong, and that diminishes me, and blah 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 blah. So,
or you start throwing up those walls, saying, "Well, look, you know, I am this age, or I have studied this, or I have these letters after my name." Da 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 da. I have to have the correct answer because I have all of this arsenal at my disposal, so to speak.
Yeah.
And that's the ego. And the ego is the consciousness of separation.
Yeah.
And the soul is the consciousness of we're in this together. And nature lives in the soul of God, and we live in the ego, period.
Mm.
And that's really, we're being asked right now. We're being tested. You know, humanity in a very personal way. What do you choose? Are you going to choose the ego and continue to beat your head against the wall till it breaks open and you lose your planet?
Yeah.
Or are you going to submit to a greater reality, to the mystery, and say, I'm going to practice virtue and I'm going to practice living consciously, even though that's not always the easiest.
Yeah.
Path.
I took a trip to visit my parents back in June 2017, and they were celebrating their wedding anniversary, and I was there for a couple of days. And the first night I was there, we were sitting there chatting. We talked for, God, I didn't get in until like 9 or 10 o'clock, and we sat for another hour or two talking, which is great. They're more like friends than they are parents. But my mom said to me, she says, you know, your two nieces, they're, you know, kind of upset with you because you never seem to get their names right. Now, it's not that I had problems pronouncing them. It was getting the name associated with the right person. And so she began flashing before me, like flashcards, their pictures. Okay, who is this? Who is this? Who is this? And I'm sitting there going, I flew 500 miles to take a test. But I said, okay, all right. So I went through and I went through and so forth. And so the next day when they showed up, fortunately, one of them showed up before the other. So my dad went over, gave her a hug, and, oh, Gabby, it's great to see you here. Okay, that's Gabby. I know who that is now, you know. I mean, just the association. Mm-hmm. But then when her sister, who is older, arrived, I'm going, well, yeah, I know who that is, you know. And so I had conversations with both of them. And it was great. But I was frustrated on that Friday night, even going into Saturday morning, going, I can't believe this. I have a test that I have to pass before I leave town, you know, and I don't want them to be upset. I want, you know, but we had a great conversation. They loved it. I loved it. We've been communicating ever since, and it's been really nice because I haven't had that contact with my relatives in that fashion. I mean, when you have a lot of them, it's hard to stay in contact with all of them. Mm-hmm. And I'm not on Facebook and I'm not on Twitter. I just don't have the time. I really don't. Too much. I would much rather be doing this,
right?
Sitting down and having these wonderful conversations that our listeners can listen to and glean from. And I want to let our listeners know you are listening to Tell Me Your Story. We're talking with Deirdre and Will, Deirdre Haid and Will Arntz. And the book is entitled The Not So Little Book of Surprises. It's rather hefty. It's not lightweight.
It's a real book.
It's a real book. I would hit it against something now, but I probably would break something. The website, by the way, is Deirdre Haid. That's DeirdreHade.com. And you can find out about both of them, both Deirdre and Will, as well as the book and more information. And we have more information coming your way here on Tell Me Your Story. I'm Richard Dugan. This is Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. We'll be right back.
Tell me your stories. I'll do my best to understand you.
And welcome back to Tell Me Your Story, New Paradigms for a New World. I'm Richard Dugan, your host. It's the not-so-little book of surprises. And surprises, to say the very least, are what we have in our lives constantly. A great surprise would be to see this book on your bookshelf or in your hands as you're flipping through it and reading some wonderful things. As a matter of fact, one of the things that I love, you know, we talked about intuition earlier. One of the things that I love to do is when I receive a book, sometimes they will put a letter, the cover letter, bio, and so forth, and they'll just put it in the book somewhere, right? But when I get the book and I find that paper there or a bookmark, I'm going, okay, that was put there maybe subconsciously for a reason. And so I will actually read the page before that page, both sides, and then maybe the page after. And okay, what's there? Mm-hmm. What's being said? Well, I just happened to open your book, the not so little book of surprises. The brain is malfunctioning because the world is malfunctioning, and the world is malfunctioning because the brain is malfunctioning. Ah, the paradox there. And if you want to see a malfunctioning brain, go to Times Square. And I have I've been to New York City. It was in 1993 with my first wife, and we actually walked up Fifth Avenue, or actually walked down Fifth Avenue and then back up again, I think, and we ended up in Central Park. And it was actually Earth Day. And there's this great fountain that we were standing by that shows up in an old television show called The Odd Couple. And we looked off to the west, and there's this mass of people heading in our direction. And, of course, I didn't know Earth Day from Father's Day. But I'm going, we've got to get out of this park, because if these people swarm around, we're going to get lost amongst each other. And, of course, we'd never been to New York, so we don't know where we're going. And there were no cell phones at that time for us. We didn't have them. But there was a great energy there, but it was both exhilarating but saddening. And we were there on a Friday afternoon when it hit me. As people are leaving their jobs and going off to whatever they're doing that evening, the excitement was, of course, the energy, just the kinetic energy of everybody moving about and everybody is just doing their thing. The sadness was that they were all oblivious of one another.
Right. Oh, you see that a lot.
Yeah.
You see that a lot.
You see it here in Santa Barbara.
You see it everywhere.
Yeah.
That being oblivious to each other, that's what living in the ego mind looks like. Because the ego is separation, where we're cut off from one another. And we are living, even though we have so many people and we run into people every day and we're with people all the time, we're all living in separate universes. And that, what that looks like is chaos.
Mm-hmm.
Chaos and confusion come from living separate from each other. You know, what I am trying to preach is that we need to drop down, drop into our into our body, into our intuition, and begin to find another way, a more real way to have connection, and that's soul to soul. That's a knowingness of another person. You can't put your finger on it. You can't measure it on a scale of a machine, but it's very real, and you know it when it happens. You know when you feel connection and you feel one with another person, one with life. And that feeling is the only thing that will fill the empty, bottomless pit of our Western ego,
mm-hmm.
where we have to fill, consume to fill mm-hmm. an emptiness.
Mm-hmm.
But nothing will fill that, nothing, except a connection to each other in the state of consciousness of our soul.
Well,
that's it.
Well, there's really not a whole lot to add to that. I mean, Deirdre pretty well. I mean, that's it.
Let me ask you then, in that light, and as I've shared many times on this program, I don't ask the questions. The universe does. I'm just along for the ride. Mm-hmm. So that's where these questions come from. And I'm curious, are we talking about the connectedness, okay? And we're also talking about the separation. But what about the aspect of who we are as human beings, as male and female, and the necessity, if maybe it isn't a necessity, I'm not sure, I'm still searching myself, for us to go off and be who we are as males or females with that group for a time and then come back to the connectedness. Is there a time, do you think, where we need to separate?
You mean where men just run off and be men and women run off and be women?
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, this is something you see, you know, evolutionary up until the recent times. I mean, the whole thing, there was this thing where the men would go off hunting
mm-hmm.
And they sit around the fire afterwards and tell hunting stories. Meanwhile, the women are back at the village and they're all hanging out together and they're making baskets and they're taking care of the kids. And that was something that you know, I see this a lot, especially what, you know, I watch with Deirdre. You know, if she doesn't get together with the gals for a certain amount of time and they just sit around and talk, you know, as men, we sort of on the side, like, what are they so interested in talking about? It doesn't mm-hmm. quite make sense to us.
Yeah.
But to the women, this is so fulfilling. And it, actually, they've even found biochemically that when women get together and share stories, endorphins. A lot of endorphins are in their body. It's something that is really built into our physiology to do this. And I think that this is something, again, we've been talking about the culture, where we think the culture's gone a little astray with all of us separated in our separate little suburban lives. You know, I see the women don't get together with all the kids. And it used to be growing the kids. You used to see this in the Native Americans, where it was much more of a community thing,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to being isolated. And here's your mom and your dad and your kids and, you know, keep them separate. So that's definitely needed. And then, again, for men, you know, we sort of joke about the men cave or get off with the guys. But that's something, too, and that's very important. And I find, personally, when Deirdre's been having time with the women and I'm off with the guy, I like smoking cigars, having a cigar. Then when we come back together, it's like, you know, oh, honey, I'm so glad to see you. And it just makes it all better. So mm-hmm. it's not one or the other. I mean, that's just a part of our human experience that we need. We need the bonding of men together and women together. And then, but that can get to be a bit much. And then the men and women to come together. And that's great. That's great, too.
Well, and I think, too, it's important we really understand what it means to be connected soul to soul. Because connected soul to soul doesn't or living in union doesn't mean that you are physically just with someone all the time.
You're tied to them at the hip.
Yeah, that's not what that means. That's called
codependence.
Codependence, yes. That's very different. What I'm talking about is an energetic experience, a feeling experience of being connected to each other and not being in our heads oblivious to each other. So what that can look like is sometimes you have to be away from those people you love. Sometimes you want to go off and do a men's retreat or a woman's retreat. That's all part of life. It's a deeper connection I'm talking about, mm-hmm. that's deeper than the physical proximity of somebody.
And sometimes you literally want to go off by yourself.
And you go, right, and have that real intimacy with yourself. And that's where it all starts, is having intimacy and not being separate from your true self. Yeah. That's where it all starts.
I remember a retreat that I took, a solo retreat. There's this wonderful, I want to say monastery, north of Phoenix, across the highway from Black Canyon City. And they have these it's run by a cloister of nuns. And they have these different little structures that they've built. It's fully outfitted. I mean, it's livable. It's not primitive conditions. And you go there, you bring your own food, and you bring whatever else is that you want, and you basically stay to yourself. It's sort of isolation and solitude, but there are other people there, and if you want to commune with them, fine. There's even a way for you to walk under the highway to the small town across the highway, which I did a couple of times. And it was frightening, but also exhilarating at the same time. And because in my case, I didn't drive there. I was dropped off by a friend. Mm-hmm. And so I was dependent on someone coming back and getting me. Although I wasn't that far from town, I'm sure I could have made it back. But those are the kinds of experiences that they can be so empowering. I did a lot of drawings and things of this nature. And then I had a men's group back in the early 90s as well. And it was only three of us. Mm-hmm. We tried to bring other guys in, but they never stayed for very long. And we used Robert Bly's Iron John as sort of our primer. Mm-hmm. And then we started hiking, which became the focal point. And the places that we went, and the things that we saw, we even hiked in the pouring rain once. I mean, it was great. It was, and of course, I realized we were crossing these streams and getting really wet. And I thought, so what? The rain's coming down. You can only get so soaking wet. Okay,
right.
There's a point of saturation where you don't have to worry about it anymore. You know, and those were great experiences. And I really encourage people to take advantage of those kinds of things because. And then to allow, like, for example, if you're in a relationship, I mean, the two of you are in a relationship, you're married, you allow the other to go off and do those kinds of things, to explore those areas of themselves with, in your case, Will, with other guys and Deirdre with other women, or solo, without threat of, are you coming back? You're not running off, are you? You know, the abandonment thing?
Yeah, well, actually, Deirdre is great at that. She not only allows me, she realizes sometimes, you know, I get kind of a little, you know, moody and a little.
So she says go?
A little negative.
Yeah, yeah. She's like, we have a place in the mountains in Colorado, too. And so she goes, honey, I think, have you been thinking about maybe a little trip to Colorado? You know, I can come join you after a little while. She's great that way. Yeah. And, you know, and I got to say that a lot of, you know, when I see a lot of relationships not working well, it's because, you know, that's not allowed to happen. People aren't allowed to have their individual time that they need. But she's great like that. Like I said, she'll just send me off and be very sweet about it. Honey, are you thinking maybe it's about that time?
Does sometimes your intuition kick in and go, yeah, you know what? I think it is.
Oh, yeah.
You know, yeah, your ego, I take it, doesn't really get in the way.
She's reading my moods, and so so when she says that, it's pretty rare that I would say, no, honey, what do you mean? No,
I love you, and I want to stay here with you.
He doesn't say that.
Why are you sending me away? You don't care anymore. You just want to get rid of me.
He's never said that. He's like, oh, you know, you're right. It's time for me to go away.
Yeah, so.
I find that extraordinary. As I shared before, I had the great pleasure of interviewing my parents, and we dialogued about a lot of these different types of things. And I remember years and years ago when I was sharing with someone about my family, oh, yeah, it's a family of eight, six kids, and, of course, the parents and all this kind of stuff. And, oh, my gosh, your folks must have really sacrificed, which, of course, was a question that I put to them. I said, did you sacrifice? And what did you sacrifice in order to have this big family? And they said nothing, because it's what we wanted.
Right.
And so and I'm bringing that full circle for folks to say, if the relationship is what you want, then let it grow. And the only way to do that is to allow that movement. I don't want to say separation. The movement, because that's what it is. It's movement.
Mm-hmm. That's fabulous, because it is movement. Separation is a state of consciousness. Mm-hmm. You know, movement is just having one space to grow and learn and do what one loves. That's very different. Mm-hmm. Then separation. Separation is when we feel alone, we feel isolated, we feel misunderstood, when we judge each other, when we condemn each other. That's all. That's separation. Mm.
In addition to this wonderful, and I can't say little, book.
Not so little book.
I need a really big pocket to stick it in. Yeah. The not so little book of surprises. What else are the two of you working on?
Well, should I tell them?
You can tell them, honey.
Okay. We've been working with this these PR folks, and the guy came up with this. He was talking, and Deirdre's the mystic, and I'm a physicist, and so he said, "Well, maybe you two should do these presentations and call it the mystic and the physicist."
Mm-hmm.
And so we floated it to people, and everyone thinks it's such an amazing thing, because on the surface it appears like it's two very separate worlds. You have a physicist and a mystic. Those are the two ends of the spectrum. And yet here we are together, and, you know, it's the coming together of those two disparate things, spirit and science, that both of us feel very strongly is where the world has to go. And there's so much similarity between the two that it's really more historical that there's been this argument through each other's throats.
Mm-hmm.
So we're going to do this, you know, little show, and really a lot of it, some of it is because, you know, I'm a physicist and have that rational mind. When I look at the mystic and the things that Deirdre reports and that she sees, it's not like, you know, the mystical has gotten this rep for being spacey and ungrounded and that. But that is not true at all. I mean, to be a real mystic, and this is something we get into in the show, takes years of training, years of training. She's done more training to be a mystic than I have training to be a physicist. Mm-hmm. I mean, because you have to do all the self-reflection. And I think that seeing it from that point of view is very important. So we're gonna hit the road.
And you're going to be putting on a presentation here in Santa Barbara. Can you tell us what people can expect? And roughly how long do these programs usually last? Is it a couple of days or just an afternoon?
It would be like an evening presentation. And part of it is some of the ideas. Part of it is Deirdre and I sort of get into bantering back and forth, and that's just kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
It's the George Burns Gracie Allen part of the show. And then – but really it's setting up so that it ends up with Deirdre taking people on a journey. And she's been doing this for years as a spiritual teacher, taking people on a journey and really giving someone the experience. So we don't want it just to be an intellectual talking heads type thing where we're doing ideas.
Right.
We basically set the whole thing up so that by the time we get to the part where she does her true magic, that people can have a real experience of the mystical, and then off they go. So that's what we're shooting for.
The mystical, though, is only mystical until it's understood. In other words, if our brains could comprehend what's really going on, it wouldn't be mystical. It would just—it's kind of the way I phrase it with the miracles of Jesus as they're portrayed in the New Testament. To him, that's just the way he was. Those are just the things he did. It was no big deal to him. because he knew, he understood, if you will, the laws of physics or the laws of spirit or the laws of the universe. Is that fair?
Well, I would say that the Jesus or Yeshua or Yeshu in the original language he spoke, yes, what he understood was that miracles are easy. It's just something that anyone can attain when one fully submits to the presence, to the mystery.
Mm-hmm.
But the mystery, as it says in Ecclesiastes, you know, there's an enigma placed in the mind of God. We will never see the beginning of time nor the end of time. So God, you want to use that word, there will always be a mystery. Our job is to understand as deep as we can. And I think that's where science and the mystical meet, because science wants to understand. They want to know the workings of a molecular structure. They want to know, why do these cells create a tumor, and why did this happen, and what can we do so that doesn't happen? And the mystic wants to know, what is the nature of reality? You know, why is it that the seasons and happen? Why is it I have these experiences? You know, what is the mind of God? We're all asking questions. Mm-hmm. And somewhere in asking the questions, I know we are going to meet. And that's what the mystic and the physicist is about, is the conversation of, okay, where do we meet? Where mm-hmm. can we meet? Because yeah. in meeting, that's where we're going to really turn this world around. In opening the doors both to science and to the mystic.
Yeah, and as far as that you were saying about, you know, do we really ever, Jesus, did he, you know, understand the miracles? You know, my understanding is that there's a certain paradox when you get outside of this physical world, these paradoxes. But the interesting thing is, even within this world, within physics, and quantum physics is famous for this, the famous quotes where one of the founders of quantum physics says, if you think you understand quantum physics, you truly don't know it at all. It is so – people don't logically understand quantum physics. It's the thing that just makes your brain go, ah!
Yeah.
Because it does things that just – whoa, you'll never understand. There are mysteries in the world you can never, we don't even understand why a little atom does what it does.
Yeah.
So that's something that, you know, you think, oh, the scientists, you understand everything. No, even as science, you look deeply enough, you get into the mystery and you go like, well, it doesn't make a sense that electron does that, but that's what it does. So, well, here we go. The adventure is on.
Exactly. What are you going to do? I mean, you can't change the laws of physics, Captain.
Yeah.
Right. And then, and also, you know, in the
good one,
the mystical on from the mystic, what I've seen is that, because I have experienced being out of time, side of time and space, and being in an alternative communication with all of creation that is not in the head. You mm-hmm. can't explain it. You can't put your finger on it. There's no language that I can tell you that experience. But we all know when we've had it.
Yeah.
But
and we all have at some
all,
time along
all
the way.
Had it. Exactly.
Yeah.
That. So that's what I came to realize was that that language barrier between the rational mind and the experience of the mystical, the mystery, all that is, that we don't have the brain yet. We don't have the physicality in the brain to make that connection yet.
Yeah.
Meaning we are in the process of being created. It says in the beginning of God's creating. It doesn't say in the beginning God created. That was a typo when they translated it.
Oh, yeah.
In the Hebrew,
there are a lot of them.
The creating. So we are still in that process of being created.
Yeah.
And I feel that physiologically, we just don't have the neurological pathways yet to cross that left to the right, right to the left fully. And so this is where we just have to say, okay, I'm going to jump off into space and accept it.
Mm-hmm.
Even though I can't understand it, I will accept it. this.
It's the statement I've heard many, many times that we adhered to or adopted before we moved here to Santa Barbara in 2006, and that is that you jump and you trust. We had both lost our jobs. We didn't know what we were going to do. Mm-hmm. We certainly could have gotten jobs back in Phoenix. But we said, well, you know, we could move. We could relocate to someplace mm-hmm. else. And, of course, our first choice was Ireland. We're still mm-hmm. working on that. And second choice, of course, was Santa Barbara. And the next thing you know, everything is just sort of falling mm-hmm. into place and following our intuition. And it was real interesting. I had no fear. I've lost jobs before, and I was scared out of my mind as to what I was going to do next. How am I going to pay the bills? Mm-hmm. This time, nothing. Mm-hmm. Nothing. And by the way, you talk about that paradox. It reminds me of the Buddhist paradox under the Bodhi tree when he finally realized, oh, the only way that I'm going to get enlightenment is to stop searching for it. And I paraphrase.
Mm-hmm.
And that's true, that the moment we let all of that go, you know, in spite of the fact that I'm on my search, it's more of a it's more of a universe guided search, if you will, or spirit guided search, and not something that I am, you know, headstrong. I've got to find the answers to these questions, or life as we know it will come to a complete end. And I have to say, I was interviewing another physicist many years ago. He wrote a book called The Fifth Dimension. It has nothing to do with the singing group of the 60s. And he said, I can show you the evidence of the first and second and third dimensions, okay, height, width, depth. He says, I cannot show you physical evidence of the fourth dimension, time, but I can show you its effect. And then he began to describe the fifth dimension, which I can't even go into. My response to him was, we were walking along the streets here in Santa Barbara. I stopped and I says, you're describing the only word I can use to codify what you have just described. You're talking about God. Now, this was a physicist, and that was what was so intriguing to me. It's also what's so intriguing to me when I interview people who are of a particular philosophical bent, you know, regardless of what it's Christian or otherwise. When they come to a certain realization of certain things, and I kind of pick up on it and intuitively I'm going, yeah, that makes sense. One man in particular who I interviewed, his book was one of the first I had read when I was interviewing, because most of the – I didn't have time. You know, I'm so busy with, you know, running radio stations and things. But I read his, and I highlighted and highlighted and highlighted, and then I began to do research based upon his book. And the bottom line was, his conclusion was Christianity specifically, because that's what he was focused on. It is totally and 100% an internal process. There is nothing external about it. Well, but that's what philosophies or religions, spirituality, that's what it is. It's an internal process. And I find that so fascinating. But that's one of the hardest things for us to grasp, again, along the lines of enlightenment. You won't get enlightenment until you stop searching for it. And until you go within, and there's this great poem by the poet I want to say Sebastian Tiberius, I think was his name. Mm-hmm. Anyway, the gist of it is that the gods, they're concerned that man is, you know, going to find out mm-hmm. how to get up where we are. We need to hide that truth from them. And, of course, they talk about where to put it, in the mountaintops and in the depths of the sea or out in outer space or this. Mm-hmm. And, of course, someone's always saying, yeah, but they'll find a way, they'll find a way. Finally, someone chimes in, I know, we'll hide it in their heart. They'll never look there. Mm-hmm. Which means you have to go within.
Yep.
Beautiful.
And
beautiful story.
I found that so fascinating when I read that. And it was introduced to me through a group that I was involved with mm-hmm. back in Phoenix that teach from the ancient wisdom teachings about all of these different things. The core was, of course, Deschardin's work about the zero point. Mm-hmm. And then it just expands and expands and expands because there's so much that we have available to us, but we sort of deny ourselves that information that can at least calm us down a little.
Well, it's like we're standing underneath a great fruit tree with all this delicious fruit, and we're not picking the fruit. We're not eating the fruit. Yeah. We're just letting it fall on the ground.
Yeah.
I mean, because that nurturing information from the pure intelligence is always there.
Yeah.
Like all we have to do is just, you don't even have to reach that far. It's just right there. But what the ego does is it makes us blind, it makes us deaf, so that we don't see that this intelligence, which is all abundance, is around us all the time.
And meanwhile, the squirrels are running around our feet, and they're like, "Hey, whoa, these walnuts are really good."
Exactly.
Whoa. Hey, want to store some walnuts away? Yeah, let's store some walnuts for winter. Sure, let's go do that.
Exactly.
Before we wrap up the program, I have to ask you, because you mentioned it earlier in the program, and I have been so curious about it, but I have books in my library that I haven't been able to crack the spines on yet. About, and you pronounced it, I believe you pronounced it Kabbalah. Mm-hmm. It's Kabbalah, the tree of life. Mm-hmm. Which, by the way, if you can imagine the tree of life in your mind, the design of it, right? And I made the reference earlier. If you look at it, the top portion, and actually there are a couple of sections of the tree of life. When you look at it, it looks like the original series Star Trek Enterprise if you were looking at it head on from the front, from the bow.
Mm-hmm. I have to look at that.
I'm not kidding you. And I'm sitting here thinking, when I first saw that, I'm thinking, I wonder if Roddenberry had that in mind in any way, shape, or form, or if it was just a wonderful coincidence, as I like to pronounce it.
Well, the thing about the Kabbalah means a downpouring of truth from pure intelligence. Pure intelligence being God. Mm-hmm. And anyone can receive Kabbalah, can receive that truth. And the thing about the classic Kabbalah that goes back into the ancient Jewish mysticism, and Christian mysticism goes all the way back to Egypt and Sumer, is that there is these archetypical geometries and numerology that really is there in all of us, just the way Joseph Campbell in Hero of a Thousand Faces, we have these archetypes of heroes. We also have this archetype of the order of the universe. And so Gene Roddenberry, who is, was a great visionary, he was tapped into that. Mm-hmm. So I would say that it wasn't a coincidence. It was him receiving information that's already around us. It's like I just said about the tree. Like, all truth is, it's already right here. Mm-hmm. Like, there's nowhere to go.
Yeah.
We just have to open our intuition and open our eyes and open our ears to seeing, hearing, and tasting what's already here. And what I love about the classical study of Kabbalah is that it goes into the really the nature and the order of and the psychology of who we are and what makes us tick and what these parts of us are and how can we take this knowledge and then become the potential of who we are. And that's what I teach. I teach from the Kabbalah, and much of this book is Kabbalah. It's reinterpreted. A lot of Kabbalah gets very difficult to understand. Mm-hmm. So I've taken some very difficult texts and distilled it so it's more understandable. Many of the sayings in the Not-So-Little Book of Surprises are from the Psalms, and I've reinterpreted Psalms so that it makes sense to us in everyday language. So that's the secret of the surprise.
Let me ask the two of you, the scientist and the spiritualist. When I asked this question of one of my guests, I was astounded and in a very good way by the answer, because I was surprised. And I would like to have your answer to this question. And that is, where do you see us as human beings evolving to? And I will give you the answer this person gave, because I said, are we going to finally understand who we are? And they said, no, we're going to finally understand who we have always been. So where do you see us evolving to?
While you're thinking.
Well, I'm thinking. You
while you're
take that,
thinking.
Honey?
Well,
I'm cogitating.
Right,
that's what
beautiful.
Scientists do.
Okay.
So I've cogitated too, but I've cogitated for decades. So I feel like.
You're ready.
Oh, now I'm ready. Now I can talk. So getting back to you, we will discover who we've always been. The beauty of that is really wrapping up the paradox that we are, our soul of who we are is outside of time and space. We are timeless. But in time, where we're living in the physical body, in time, there is beginning, middle, end. There, that's time. So we are, I see it that we are in an evolution of becoming. And we are an evolution of, yes, being who we always were, that God spark, but a more mature beingness of that. Mm-hmm. And again, this gets back to the Kabbalah, and that we were created in the image, not the physical, but we were created in an energetic template of pure intelligence. And that in order for pure intelligence to create us, pure intelligence had to break itself.
Mm.
And in breaking itself, imperfection came. And we are living in the world of imperfection, whereas God, what we were born from was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
So the journey we are on is to re-knit. That's what redemption means. We get this from Revelation. That's what salvation means. All of these words mean that we are to re-knit or to heal ourselves back together again so that we become the God self in perfection.
So perfection is, the reunification.
The reunification. And that's why I was saying before, you know, the dramas will never stop, stories will never stop, disagreements will never stop, because we are lifetime after lifetime after lifetime in the story of rehealing a brokenness where God broke to create us. And every time we have a healing, the world of separation becomes a world of one. And when we do this enough, then we'll be, you know, we'll hit the goal.
Okay.
If you can say a goal, so to speak. But mm-hmm. in the again, it gets back to trying to put something into words that's out of time.
Yeah.
That this journey that we're on in our time and space, it is a journey, but in non-time and space, everything's already here right now.
Mm.
If you can just kind of hold that paradox.
Sure.
Yeah, and I for me, you know, sort of where where are we going? I mean, I keep coming back to it. It is a journey, and if you sort of end up right back where you started, that kind of makes all this purposeless. I mean, it's like,
yeah,
why bother?
Same thing.
It's when, the question is, are you on a circle or are you on a spiral?
Yeah,
and you know, my take is that things change and things evolve, and there is learning. You gather knowledge, you got wisdom. So after all this, you're just exactly the same. No, it may be what you've always been, but it's the new improved version. So
well, what you've always been is the potential.
The potentials. Right. It would be like saying, okay, here's a walnut. Here's a walnut tree. They are the same thing. I mean, that's a nice idea, but you kind of look. You say, "Well, the potential's in there. Maybe the DNA inside them is the same." So you could say there is a similarity, but there's also a difference.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, yeah, you get back to what you've always been, and you're different at the same time. And then, you know, we're back into the world of paradoxes.
Well, what happens is that we, on the journey, we are here to gain wisdom and understanding, and that leads us to truth. And that is the crown of the Tree of Life, the top three sephirot of Keter, Chokmah, Bina, which is truth, wisdom, and understanding. And that we are here to take the rest of the tree, which is all the parts of our psychology and our consciousness, and lift it into the crown.
Mm.
And when this happens, we become self-realized, mm-hmm. self-actualized, and we become wise. We have a depth of understanding, and we know truth at its highest level. And that's why we're here. That's why the story that we're living is in the story we're living. That's the whole reason we're here. That's it, from beginning to end. And I have a lot of hope that we will make it. Sometimes
too.
I wonder, but I do.
I'm going to keep that hope alive myself.
Yes.
Because there are times, I know we get a little frustrated mm-hmm. and we're going, I don't know. It's not mm-hmm. looking good, but we'll see how it unfolds, and we'll just keep the hope alive in that regard. Before I let you go, first of all, thank you so much for coming into the studio and sharing with us, the two of you. This has been wonderful, and I hope that we get to do it again in the not-too-distant future. I think I need to connect with you as far as a class in the Kabbalah or the
Love
Kabbalah.
That.
It has always intrigued me. I have a set of cards of the Kabbalah, and it goes through each of the, what did you call them?
The Sephirot.
And what are the connecting lines? Is there a name for
there's
those?
There's a name,
okay,
but
well,
I don't.
We won't, well, I'll save that for class.
Right.
And, Will, thank you so much for joining us. Before I let you go, I want to remind our listeners that the book is entitled The Not-So-Little Book of Surprises. The website, of course, it's Deirdre and Deirdre Hade, and that's deirdrehade.com. That's the website where you can get more information. And before I let the two of you go, I have three final questions for you that I ask all of my guests. And I'm going to bounce back and forth so that you can each prepare while the other's answering, but you won't get to do that on the opposite question. The first question I'll put to you, Will, and then to you, Deirdre, is who is Will Arntz?
I would say a work in progress.
And who is Deirdre Hade?
I am a seer, and my purpose is to share what I see in the mystical worlds so that we can all be happier, live in more joy. That's where I live, and that's who I am.
What is it that you hope to or want to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
My hope is to bring people a deep sense of connection, purpose, and inner peace, healing in the relationships and in life. That's my hope, and I have faith that at least in my small corner, hope I can achieve some of that. But it takes all of us really coming together and to that end, I do want to say that you can also go to bookofsurprises.com. That's easier to remember. And we've got many free meditations and videos based on the Tree of Life, and would love to share that with
Wonderful.
Anyone who – it's free. It's there for you.
And, Will, what do you hope mm-hmm. to achieve through the work that you are doing now?
Well, one of the things is I want people to have a good time. I want people to, you know, joie de vivre, you know, and to me that's very important. And I don't just mean joie de vivre, have a good time, like for entertainment. Yes, it's entertainment, but it's something that just kind of gives people a sparkle in their life. And part of that is the wisdom. Part of that is the understanding of the way life works. But part of it is also just the sheer joy of it.
Mm. And the final question, I'll start with you, Will. What is your life's purpose?
Well, it appears to be, much to my surprise, to get this wisdom and knowledge out to the public at large. You know, I made that movie, What the Bleep Do We Know?, which was sort of a way to start with that. And I see this book, it's really a cont-